George Dyson was just a boy when the first computers were being built, but he had a bird's-eye view of it all, because the most famous of them was built in his own backyard. Dyson's parents were fellows at the Institute for Advanced Study, where a legendary team of mathematicians and engineers developed a machine called MANIAC, the prototype for the computers we all use today. Dyson's been around computers all his life. In his new book, Turing's Cathedral, he tells the story of the very first computers. He told Steve Paulson he was inspired by a memory.
I remember sitting in, you know, Steve Jobs' hotel room seeing the first Next machine demonstrated and stuff. And I wanted to understand the real beginnings of it and still think that we don't, sort of as a culture, we don't really have a common creation myth of how this world started at the very beginning. We do sort of in the sense of IBM or Apple or Microsoft, but not that actual, how did the first 32 by 32 by 40 bit matrix happen and who were the people who did it?
So is that what you're trying to do here, to tell that first creation story, the first creation myth?
Exactly. It's the creation myth of the address matrix, this world we live in where you can, you know, how is it that you can just type in a numerical coordinate and get back the weather in Stockholm or whatever you're looking for? I mean, that works because of this amazing thing that was done at the beginning.
So who were these early scientists and engineers who were working on this computer? What kinds of people were they?
They were from absolutely all walks of life and from many different countries, people who now would probably have, you know, trouble getting visas to come to the United States, but here they were. Almost all of them had come through the war. A lot of the work was done by women who had been brought into the workforce during the war and given responsibilities they might not have had in peacetime. And it was a small group of people, at the most 20 or 30 people altogether.
And John von Neumann took over this project to build the first computer?
Yeah, except it wasn't the first computer. There were many other computers first, and it just happened to be the computer that got most widely copied. And the other thing to remember is that Alan Turing was in Princeton in the late 1930s, 1936 to 38. He was there. So he left a lot of his ideas behind when he left. And von Neumann came along and put them all together at this institute that has no direct connection to Princeton University, but happened to sort of be symbiotic with the university, but independent, and was specifically designed not to have any engineers. It was very much against the rules to bring engineers there and build something.
But there were obviously engineers who were working on this computer design, right?
Yeah, von Neumann kind of snuck them in. I mean, at first they started in the basement next to the boiler room, and then they were moved out into a concrete building built way back on the other side of a field.
And they're young for the most part, right?
Mostly in their 20s. You know, the people who were 30 were sort of considered old.
Now, part of the fascination of the story is that the computer, or at least the computer that von Neumann worked on, was invented pretty much at the same time as the hydrogen bomb was created. In fact, the same people made both. And you make the case that you really cannot separate the two.
Yes. I mean, you know, one way to explain it is that during World War II at Los Alamos, these sort of pure mathematicians got to play around with real hardware and high explosives, and they were very successful. And so the sort of question was, what next? And computers was definitely the exciting thing to come. And the deal was sort of made. I mean, in one sense, you can say it's a deal with the devil, but if they would produce this weapon, they would get this fantastic machine to do all the science that they wanted to do with.
Did these scientists and engineers who were at the Institute for Advanced Studies realize the moral quandary they were in? They were part of the war machine. They were building the deadliest weapon on Earth, but they had to do this if they wanted access to the technology to build these computers.
No, they were very aware, and a number of the engineers I spoke to had second thoughts to the extent that they left. But on the other hand, you have to remember that many of the people working on this had been through the Holocaust in Europe and lost most of their families, and there was a very valid view that, you know, we came really close in World War II to being, you know, I mean, we didn't win that war by very much, and there was a very strong feeling that we needed to make sure that America had had the upper hand.
So as you were looking into this history, what were the biggest surprises for you?
Well, one would be just simply the subject we were talking about, that von Neumann was publicly known and still sort of vilified by many people for having advocated preemptive attack on the Soviet Union before they got their own nuclear weapons.
Really? He wanted us to go ahead and remove the Soviets from power?
Yes, at a very narrow window of time after World War II. He sort of saw what was coming, and he had great fear of Stalin. And I thought that was a bluff. I came into this thinking that, you know, he was a game theorist and a poker player, and that you have to have a strong bluff if you want to deter, you know, your adversary. But when in doing this project, I got access to his very private letters and papers, and it was clear to me that he was not bluffing. He really believed that, but only for a short time, and then he changed his mind. He was willing to change his mind, and he did. So that was a surprise to me. And the other things that surprised me were just simply the extent to which Clary von Neumann, his wife, had actually done a lot of the early programming, and the role of this Italian-Norwegian mathematical biologist Nils Baricelli, who's really one of the strong characters in the book, who just had absolutely way ahead of their time ideas at the very beginning about how digital organisms would evolve, and not only thought about it but actually did experiments.
When you talk about digital organisms, what do you mean?
Well, in the simplest sense, you're simply talking about strings of code, strings of numbers that reproduce. So they make copies of themselves, and then in various ways those copies can change. They can become larger. They can sort of cross-link or cross-breed. And this is sort of an evolutionary process that started at the beginning, and it's, you know, in my view, it's still going on. Things like, you know, a Windows operating system is a very large and very successful number. Now, whether there's a difference between saying organism and saying life, I mean, I differentiate those two. You can say General Motors is an organism. That doesn't necessarily mean it's alive.
Now, you said this guy was working on this in 1953. Wasn't this also the time when James Watson and Francis Crick were working on the code for DNA?
Yes. What was amazing was that Baricelli started working on this actually in 1951. So he was doing this before the Watson-Crick results came out. And then when the Watson-Crick sort of discovery that, yes, you know, DNA really was a self-replicating tape, that just a tape that can make a copy of itself, a perfect copy. And this was so absolutely. In fact, Baricelli, I mean, he talked about numerical molecules. He saw it all very, very clearly.
Now, there's a personal story for you as well in this history. This research that we've been talking about happened at the Institute for Advanced Studies in Princeton, where your father, Freeman Dyson, worked. Do you have any memories of these scientists and mathematicians?
Yes, I have a lot of memories. And, of course, people always leave out that my mother was there, too. I mean, my father and my mother met there. She was essentially a postdoc, and he was actually not a postdoc. He didn't have his degree. So I grew up there as a child playing in this, you know, the Institute was in the middle of 600 acres of woods. And what the famous scientists and mathematicians were doing was really not very interesting, just, you know, writing papers, and I had no interest in that. But then in this back outbuilding, Julian Bigelow had built this machine and left a lot of scrap. Myself and one or two other kids used to play in there, take that stuff apart. You know, we sort of made no distinction between going off and catching frogs and turtles and reptiles in the woods and going into the barn and, you know, taking apart relays. It was just sort of all interesting to us. I mean, and kids are still that way today. I mean, it's just a sort of universal nature to want to catch things and take things apart.
George Dyson is the author of Turing's Cathedral, The Origins of the Digital Universe.